The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Today, North London derby thriller. Rizicky, Walcott and Sanya as effective as Lasagna are giving Spurs problems with their runs. Are Arsenal back and what of Harry's England career? Big questions. Carling Cup final. Pod salutes Liverpool. If they can beat the sixth place side in the Championship on penalties, what can stop them now? All that to come. Plus Mark Hughes, who piddled in his chips. Terry Connor's Wolves debut. Sid Lowe in Spain. Milan, Juve, missed goal madness. And what really happened in that Bournemouth half-time team talk? All of that in today's Football Weekly. Hi, everybody. What a packed pod we have today. Here with me are Simon Burnton. Hi.
Hello.
Simon.
Hi.
Paul McInnes.
Hiya.
Hi. Greg Ruffley.
Hi, James.
And John Ashdown.
Hello.
So much to discuss. I don't know if we'll even have time to talk about your jumper, Paul, which is a shame because it is a special bit of knitwear.
It really works well.
What's the thinking behind that?
I just thought low-key today, not particularly kind of smart, but yet not too informal because I'm coming on the air with you.
Yeah, it's a kind of lemon-limey affair.
Yeah, it's broken out into lines and there's a nice bit of pink down the middle which just says I'm confident about who I am and I will project it wherever I go.
Right. Listeners are going to lap that up.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, now, Paolo Bandini's on the line as well. Hi, Paolo.
Hi, James. How are you?
I'm very well. I bet you're well, aren't you?
I'm in reasonably chipper spirits this morning, yeah.
Yeah, North Bank's very own Paolo Bandini. All right, I was going to get a quick comment from the boys, but you go for it then. What was it like being at the Emirates through this extraordinary, this monumental, this cathartic Arsenal experience?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly quite an afternoon. I think a lot of people, and I know we always tend to forget things that happened even a week ago and jump on the thing that's happening this very second. But I think a lot of Arsenal fans at the weekend feel like this was the signature moment of Arsenal at Emirates Stadium so far. And I know you could look back to last season and talk about the win over Barcelona, but that, while against a higher profile and more special opposition perhaps, that felt a bit like a smash and grab, whereas this felt more like something substantial, really. Arsenal, despite going two goals down, pretty comprehensive winners in the end and had played fantastically in against a rival who, for the first time in a long time, are actually looking down on Arsenal in the table and who we've been hearing a lot about a power shift. And look, you know, these things haven't suddenly gone away. Arsenal are still 7 points behind Tottenham. Arsenal season hasn't suddenly been transformed in a day. But I think it was, as you say, a cathartic moment and one that a lot of people at Arsenal, I think a lot of fans, desperately felt like they needed after that 4-0 hammering at Milan.
Tell us a little bit about the mood in the crowd. How it shifted, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was. It was obviously you can imagine that it was not especially positive after conceding the first goal so early. It was interesting, even just coming in. I can't remember a time really in many years where I've gone to an Arsenal game like that, and people you talk to outside the stadium, people you talk to inside the stadium, so many people just going into it and saying, "Well, I hope we can get a draw out of this game." So many Arsenal fans looking at it from that point of view, and I'm sure there were people who are more positive than that as well, but I did hear a lot of people, even just in the 5 minutes before kickoff, saying, "Yeah, I'll be pretty pleased if we can come out of this with a point." Actually, Arsenal fans. So it was a low expectation to start with, but then when Saha scores that goal, which you know felt like there was a heavy dose of misfortune in that for Arsenal, with the deflection coming off of Vermaelen, then you get the penalty, which again it felt like Arsenal had actually been sort of on top in that spell between the two Tottenham goals. They've been maybe not creating as much as they'd like, but they've been pushing Tottenham back and looking for something. And then Tottenham come straight down the other end, score again, a penalty that a lot of people, I think, felt was contentious. I have to admit, I've actually still not seen a replay of it, so I can't comment any more than what I saw at the time, which is it did look like Bale went down quite easily. But and then for Adebayor to score that goal and you know, he insisted on doing a little dance. It seemed like some of his Tottenham teammates were kind of trying to encourage him back up the pitch, but Adebayor wanted to stay behind and do a little dance in front of the North Bank. So there was a lot of reasons for this to be a difficult, but you know, there were a lot of reasons why it was particularly difficult for Arsenal fans to take what was going on at this moment in time. And yeah, it was pretty poisonous. It was a pretty nasty atmosphere at that moment. And there was a lot of frustration, a lot of it being you know, turned alternately on players such as Adebayor for Tottenham, but also on certain Arsenal players. And I think with the way the one who's obviously been singled out in a lot of reports this morning, and I think it's fair, is Theo Walcott. He wasn't playing very well in the first half, and a lot of fans were getting on him when he was making mistakes and making poor touches and generally not looking very effective. And then, of course, he turned it all around.
Paolo, if the mood was so poisonous in the first half, what was it like? What feelings of joy as you embraced your fellow Gooners in the second half then?
Yeah, it was pretty delirious. It was pretty delirious. But once Arsenal had that goal and once there was that sense of momentum going, it turned very quickly back the other way. And actually, because it is a big stadium and because it is, you have got 60,000 people there, when it does start rocking, when it does actually get in that rare situation where you have got all the fans really getting behind the team, I think that does lift Arsenal. I think that does have an impact on the pitch. And it was interesting. It sort of felt like, I think you've seen this performance from Arsenal before, but generally you've only seen it in 10 and 15 minute bursts at the end of halves. It felt like they got into that zone that they sometimes get into, Arsenal, when they're desperately chasing a goal and they get one and they're trying to get another one for a winner or trying to get another one for whatever reason. It can become a bit like a snowball effect. It just feels like the crowd get louder and louder and they start creating these chances in quick succession. It just felt like that sort of spiraled for the entire match after that Sanya had scored that second goal. So, as I say, I think a lot of people felt this was the best moment they've experienced since Arsenal moved to the Emirates, which is a significant period of time. So there was a lot of hugging strangers, and I don't know if it's something that can necessarily carry over and become something longer lasting, because you've got one result there. I think it's more about on an individual day when the crowd show that enthusiasm and the players respond to it, and I don't know that necessarily that'll be the case in a few weeks' time when they play Aston Villa at home, for instance.
A big question, that. And, of course, Liverpool coming up at the weekend. Paolo, enjoy the moment while it lasts then, eh?
Yeah, I certainly will, James. Thank you.
Nice one. Thanks, Paolo. They're going to let him down, though, aren't they? Soon.
Probably at Anfield this weekend, James. I'd like to think, anyway. I mean, just make a general point about that match. It's another match in which the top four teams or top five teams have played against each other, and the scoreline's been a crazy scoreline with seven goals in that match. And I think there's been an average of 7.3 goals in the matches between the top teams. And there's no,
I'm going to go with 4.86.
Really?
Yeah. No, I'm not kidding. I think that was the figure.
Joe was twittering 4.9 yesterday.
4.9. Well,
the top five playing against each other.
Well, right. Okay. If you just mention these matches then, anyway.
Okay.
Man United 8, Arsenal 2. Man United 1, Man City 6. Spurs 1, Man City 5. Chelsea 3, Arsenal 5. Chelsea 3, United 3.
Yeah.
Those matches, I mean, that's why English teams aren't doing well in the Champions League this year. I mean, the organisation in the defences has been pretty poor. And it's been great to watch these sides going these ding-dong battles against one another. But that, I mean, you saw it even with Spurs' defence yesterday. They were just dragged out of position so easily by Arsenal's attackers.
Well, that's the thing. When I saw the team sheet, Rizicki and Benny Yoon in there, I thought Arsenal were going to get torn apart in midfield. Did Harry mess it up? What was the story?
Yeah, well, I think Redknapp messed it up by toying with a system which has worked by... I mean, I thought he brought Sahar in to be a reserve striker when Adebayor perhaps wasn't fit, not to play up front with him. And, I mean, Bale's been very good out wide, not in a central position where he played yesterday. And I just think when the game turned against Tottenham yesterday, they were just found wanting in midfield. Sahar isn't the kind of player who's going to track back and help Scott Parker out and Modric. That's why Scott Parker got sent off. He was trying to do it all on his own in the midfield, and you know, he lunged in twice because he's probably frustrated that nobody else was trying to help him.
That said, though, Sahar did go off at half time when it was two apiece, and he did sort of revert to, you know, a slightly way look to make it more solid by bringing Sandro on, and that really didn't work.
It's the third time this calendar year that I've, so in the last couple of months, that I've seen Tottenham play without Aaron Lennon. And although Lennon isn't normally classed among their finest players, and his contribution is often patchy in terms of end product, I think that they're a vastly inferior team when he's not in it. I think that if you've got Bale on the left and Lennon on the right, the opposition is always going to be stretched and are worried in a way that with just one, or particularly with no wide players, they aren't. And that, in many ways, their attacking game is kind of based around working the ball through the middle and finding the width. And if the width isn't there, then they just seem lost for ideas.
Either way, they would struggle if that midfield three of Arsenal's played well, which they did. And they kept a lot of ball. They were making good runs, pulling the four about.
Sure.
For all Arsenal's frailties, and I agree with Greg about the defence, those two goals were horror show. And they did actually play something close to Arsenal attacking football, and that has traditionally been good enough to beat Spurs.
If we don't envisage necessarily Arsenal pushing on from this, do we envisage this run of slightly worrying form from Spurs, the 0-0 with Stevenage and now this? Do we see this snowballing?
The issue maybe is, or the thing you might want to discuss, is the old Harry job situation.
Do you think that's having an impact?
It's having an impact, yeah.
Is it?
Well, I wonder whether it is, yeah, because...
Why would it have an impact?
Because he's just been so kind of... I don't know. I think he's been very upfront with the media, as per usual. And he has been saying, you know, I've got a job to do at Tottenham. But he's been very coy and not distancing himself from the England job. And everybody assumes that if that offer is made, he will take it. And I think that kind of will say to players, hang on a minute, where's the project going? Where are we going to be next year? Is there more pressure on us to deliver something now? And just indeed about Harry's commitment to the whole thing.
I also think the position kind of is possibly causing it, in that they're not necessarily close enough to the title winners to... I mean, not that motivation should be a problem, but like it could be, in that like they lost to Man City and then they fell away from the title chase. They've got a big gap below them to fourth place. Mm. And therefore, they're kind of like the old Charlton syndrome, where they'd start the season very well and end up kind of in this no man's land between being somewhere and being nowhere, you know.
Mm. Like that horse in the film with the barbed wire. Yeah,
and that also has been kind of exacerbated by Harry a little bit, because when they had those games that they could have gone quite through to the top two and they didn't perform, and he was very circumspect about it. It doesn't really matter because we're never aiming for the title.
Let's talk about Man United. You see the game, Paul?
I've crowdsourced my opinion on this.
Have you? All right.
Because lots of the
family... Because they went to your team.
The Clan MacInnes were in attendance at Carrow Road.
All right.
And
it was narrow at Carrow, that was the thing. But they just snuck it, didn't they, the Red Devils?
Yeah, they snuck it. And in the end, Fergie was very magnanimous afterwards, and to the extent that he kind of turned Paul Lambert into a coy little schoolgirl in the aftermatch, when Lambert didn't know that Ferguson had complimented the side and said that Norwich deserved to win. And when he heard, he kind of like, ooh, really? But he was magnanimous before the game as well. I thought it was quite interesting he compared Norwich to Aberdeen. Anyway... we were just done by Classic United. Classic United, determination, aggression, a little touch of quality.
Doesn't get more classic than Ryan Giggs.
No, it doesn't. But I mean, doesn't get more classic than Grant Holt. Grant Holt's goals.
No, I'm just saying from a United point of view, because of the 900 games.
Yeah, I know that. I know that's what you wanted me to talk about. Yeah. But I kind of thought, why don't I talk about
Grant Holt
instead?
How many games has he played for his club?
He's probably played about 115.
Right, that's why everyone was talking about him.
Okay, yeah, all right, fine. Yeah. It was just a lovely goal and he should get called up to the England squad now. All those strikers have been dropped out.
Rooney's got a sore throat. That
exactly.
Sounds terrible.
Yeah.
And it's a shame, because there was this friendly that he wanted to play.
Can I say something about Paul Scholes' goal? I know you don't want to go the Man United route, Paul, but...
it's only fair, they did win the game.
The timing of his run was brilliant. If you watch it again, he's one of these players where most British players would just... bomb on into the box and not break the stride in the run to get onto the end of a cross. He ran in and then stopped still, let the defender run away from him so he could no longer feel him behind him anymore. Then he turned round to see where Scholes had gone, and that's when Scholes made his run to get in front, which just proves you what a great footballing brain
he's
got.
Who did that run, sorry?
That was Paul Scholes.
Yeah, but hang on, which one was Scholes? Because he was running on and then he was turning around to see where Scholes was.
So,
I know he's good, but...
You know what I mean. The Norwich defender turned around.
Oh, I see, sorry, the Norwich like defender. Fox, sorry, everybody
Dave
else got
Fox
that.
He turned around to see where Scholes had gone. And
the defender?
Defender did, and then Paul Scholes darted in front of him and was in so much space to score. And just the best footballers don't move, and British football is a very rare thing. You know, they do it on the continent.
Similar with Giggs for the winner as well.
Yeah,
I mean, his run was brilliant.
Excellent. All right, well, Man United keeping pace with Man City there at the top of the table. Of course, Man City beating Blackburn Rovers, featuring the Olsen twins. That's very exciting. There we go. And Chelsea won against Bolton, etc.
Yeah,
blah,
I
blah, blah.
City, I saw City on Saturday. I thought they looked pretty good.
Really?
I mean, yeah, Blackburn didn't really offer up much.
No.
City didn't have to get out of second gear, but what they did very effectively.
Can I just mention something about Frank Lampard as well?
Please do.
Yeah, I mean, he scored his 10th goal, he scored over 10 goals in 9 consecutive seasons, but I just looked at his stats before and they are incredible. For somebody who, like, the last 2 seasons has been on his way down, He scored 2003 or 2004, 20 goals, 22 goals, 23 goals, 22 goals, 22 goals, 23 goals, 30 goals, 15 goals, and 13 goals in 36 games this season. I mean, that kind of record for the midfield is astonishing, and that includes England appearances as well. And even though he's not been picked every week this, you know, this season, he's still probably far ahead of most of the midfielders who've been playing week in, week out as well.
Jamie Redknapp.
Potentially an exciting partnership for England as well with Stephen Gerrard.
Well, I know, yeah. It could be, yeah. Maybe see what Stuart Pearce does in his game after this Holland one.
Sorry, Paul.
No. Oh. Just Jamie Redknapp had his say this morning, his valedictory say. Well, he just said that sometimes do not go looking for trouble. Trouble will find you.
What does that mean?
Well, it essentially means that Andre Villas-Boas should have picked Frank Lampard on Wednesday.
Right.
Jamie Redknapp told him so. And he showed naive management.
All right, thanks to Jamie for those Confucian stylings. We're going to be...
I just think with the whole... I mean, that's such nonsense. I mean, if you're a baker,
yes,
a professional baker, where even if your flour isn't great and you've not got the best yeast,
yes,
and you're borrowing somebody else's water that you're not happy with,
yes,
if you're in a baking competition against basically a horse with a penny tied around it, you're going to make the best bread. That was Chelsea against Bolton.
Thank you, Barry.
That took me all morning.
All right. We're going to move on now, and part two features more exciting cousin-based football themes with the Carling Cup final. Up next, it's what producer Ben is calling the most awkward family reunion since the Gigs last got together. The Gerrards, face-to-face, toe-to-toe.
I thought you meant me and my dad.
No, Greg.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm talking about the Carling Cup final.
Yes.
Yeah, and you were there.
I was there yesterday, yes.
Gerrard on either team, but before we get onto that, your impressions of Wembley. It was your first trip there in, what, ages, no?
Yeah, for me personally, since the late 80s. For Liverpool fans generally since 1996. It was odd going to a big game, is it, with a huge Liverpool following, and us being kind of like the naive fans who didn't really know our way around, and all these Cardiff fans are coming up to us going, I don't want to show you around, mate. You know, we've been here four times.
And lost every time, have they not?
Well, we've kind of sorted that out now. But I mean, going to the match on an escalator is just something that is just far too flash for football. I mean, I do like my football to be a little bit more down and dingy, you know. And there's no urinals at Wembley. No urinals at Wembley. Can you believe that?
Did they just forget to put them in?
I don't know. But basically, so you go into the toilets, and all these closets are all sealed, and just horrendous noises and stinks coming out of them because fellas have been on the ale since whatever time in the morning, and are then filling them up. It was quite grim. So they've got some things right and some things wrong at Wembley. Anyway, I know you want me to talk about the match rather than.
How about that penalty shootout then, eh?
Well, I mean, there was echoes of 2001 against Birmingham beforehand, but I never imagined it would be carried right through to a penalty shootout at the end. And, I mean, Liverpool have got a very good record on penalties in competitions, and it came through again. But at the beginning, it didn't look that way.
Were you watching between your fingers?
I was pretty much done in by that point. I was a bit slumped. The whole thing was quite exhausting because Cardiff just wouldn't let up all game, and I thought the centre backs were really, really good. Hudson and Turner. I mean, to kind of keep Suarez pretty quiet throughout a match, and you six play championship sides, very impressive. To keep Carroll quiet, maybe not so impressive. I mean, his movement was pretty non-existent, and I thought Liverpool should have maybe started with Bellamy from the start.
Right.
Yeah, Downing was very good, though. Downing had a great game, and he showed that he has actually got balls by taking that penalty and taking a very good penalty as well.
Was that his first really good performance for Liverpool this season?
Well, he played well against Brighton, funnily enough, another championship side.
Right.
So I don't know if there's a theme emerging. But no, he's played on a couple of occasions this season. He has... His touches look good, and right at the beginning of the season, when maybe he didn't have as much pressure on him in terms of people weren't looking for him to perform at that point. I think now he's started to take on his fullback, and which he's not done for much of the season. He's kind of turned around and give the simple ball back inside and copped out, and that's why I was very surprised that he took a penalty, because that showed that he did actually have nerve.
Hmm. All right, well, 45 shots I believe that Liverpool had all in all in the course of this game, and yet Cardiff were one Windy Miller away from actually winning the cup.
Yeah, I mean, it's indicative of Liverpool's season to have so many shots and still not put the game away.
Yeah.
But I thought, I mean, if Cardiff had have scored, I didn't feel like Liverpool were far and away the better side, because a lot of those shots went so far wide and over that it was because of Cardiff's great defending that they'd limited them to long range shots. I thought Kenny Miller's first touch for that chance at the end was immense. His second one was pretty awful.
What about Andy Carroll's lunging tackle on him? Was it not him who put him off?
I mean, I was so far. Oh yes, no, you're right. Yeah, it was. Yeah, yeah. So he did do something.
Yeah, he did. Carroll. He did the kind of the negative bit of his game quite well, I thought.
Yeah.
Rearranging the words in Kenny Dalglish's comments after after the game, it's possible to construct a sentence in which he says that you're going to go on and win other things. Other League Cup winners since 2000 include Leicester, Blackburn Rovers, Borough and Birmingham. Bit of perspective there, Greg.
Yeah, I mean, we could aim for the playoffs in another couple of years' time, couldn't we, if things go well. I don't know. If you look at what Houllier did after the 2001 season, he had Liverpool finish second and improved dramatically the season after.
Right.
They went downhill after that again. Yeah. But, you know, I think it's very important for what Dalglish is doing because he kind of, with winning a trophy, it's maybe bought him a bit of time with owners who necessarily don't see the Carling Cup like a lot of people do in Britain as something that maybe isn't as big a trophy as they imagine. So maybe them turning up and seeing this and this occasion go well will give him a little bit of stock with them to go and spend again in the summer.
It was also a question of nerve, wasn't it? I mean, they did hold their nerve conceding that late equaliser. Penalties, obviously, the missing the first two, second one quite horrendously. Mm. That might mean something.
Oh, yeah. No, I think, yeah, and there's a lot of there's players in that squad who have never won anything. Even Dirk Kuyt, I mean, he's won stuff in Holland, but for Liverpool, he's been there all that time and he's never won anything. And, Charlie Adam down in plays like that.
All right, well, commiserations to Cardiff. Let's move back onto the Premier League because there were plenty of other surprises there, one of the biggest of which has to be Wolves. Their trip to Newcastle, which looked like it could end very unpleasantly for their brand new manager, Terry Connor. But instead, especially when they went in at half time 2-0 down, eh?
Mm. Yeah, came back very well to draw it 2-2. You quite often get these little bouncers after you've appointed an assistant manager in as the sort of top dog, number one, because he does usually act as a buffer for the players. The players know him incredibly well, and so they play for him, certainly in those first few games. The danger is once that initial boost has run out.
I think that happened with Steve Keane as well, didn't it?
There's other examples. Les Reed is the famous one at Cheltenham. I imagine he didn't really have much of a bump at first. Keith Millen at Bristol City quite recently. There's no sort of historical pattern, I don't think, that with assistants going on to do particularly well or particularly badly over the long term. It's a tough ask for him though to keep him up, I think.
Mm. Although they have moved out of the drop, 1 point clear of the drop now. Wolves. As for Newcastle, they've got a big derby clash with the Sunderland, who were involved in another of the big surprises, going to West Brom, who've been rotten at home. And Liz, was it 4-0? 4-0.
Yeah, two for Ed and Wingy.
Good Lord.
The reports suggested that this was a performance that has been waiting to come out from West Brom, that they are capable of playing quite efficient, not quite long ball, but direct football.
Right.
They've got a couple of very good technical players in the middle now. Morrison had another very good game.
Mm. Martin O'Neill brought down to earth by the man who was last season's Martin O'Neill in many ways, Roy Hodgson, and last season's Steve Bruce as well before that. But anyway, well done to him. So Wolves moving out of the bottom three, 1 point clear. QPR now just goal difference off it, after being beaten at home by Fulham. Icarumba, yet again, a new signing gets sent off. And yet again, Mark Hughes looking grim and tight-lipped and a little bit angry.
Yeah, there was a slight handshake-related imbroglio.
Tell us about it, Simon.
Martin Jol, the managers shook hands, and Jol obviously thought it went so well that he would try a little head clasp.
Was it a head clasp? He just put his arm out. It wasn't clear if he was going for the head or the shoulder.
I think he was going for a pat of the head.
Was
he? Kind of, there, sorry you lost.
Right.
Pat of the head.
Hughes was having none.
He's not a big one, not big on head pats.
Right.
Don't you pat Hughes's head.
No.
And now the world knows that.
All right, if they had any doubt.
Is he? Hughes.
He's saying
he's not big on friendliness in general.
That seems to be the thing. A lot of talk about how he got a bigger office the first thing he did when he went to Fulham. Is that an undercurrent, an underlying theme of his managerial years?
Yeah, I've heard that at City. I know Didi Haman said that he would take the staff would go on a separate bus to the coach, which the team players were on. Oh. And then when they turned up in cities and they went to have a meal, they'd go the separate way to the players again and kind of wouldn't mix with the players very often, and just thought it was a poor style of management. And I don't know, it just seems like that's not going to be very good for QPR, is it, in the future?
No. Well, his record's not exactly setting the world on fire at the moment. 8 games, they spent all that money in January, but 8 games, they've only won 2 of them, and they've lost 5. They're 17th on goal difference at the moment, and they have a tough run coming up. Everton at home, then Bolton away, Sunderland away, and Arsenal at home.
Although they're not getting hammered, the last 7 defeats have all been by single goals. Mm. But they have lost to people. I mean, losses to people like Wolves, Blackburn, Fulham, Norwich at home. And of the 12 games they've got left, they've got the top 6 still to play.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Mm. Mm. And there is just a question, I think, about how effective some of these signings have been or will prove to be. One of my friends who was at the game, he said, and this was some achievement apparently, but it was Sean Mike Phillips's worst performance of the season.
Really?
Yeah, and that, you know, they had all the names on the pitch on Saturday, and none of them were really getting out of 5s and 6s at the end.
Yeah. It was interesting actually. I thought what Hughes said sort of after the game about the sending off with Diakite, I think he pronounced it, and how he said, oh, he's come from the French league, so he's clearly not used to how English officials referee a game. But surely that's part of Hughes's job, is to tell his players exactly how they should play. And he said, well, he was just being too aggressive. Well, if he's being too aggressive after his first booking, tell him to be slightly less aggressive before he gets booked again.
It's a very easy excuse for a new arrival's red card, when in fact his second yellow card was just a terrible tackle. And I don't think that they may have referees who speak a different language in France, but a terrible tackle is still.
And it was identical to his first tackle as well, so it's like you might have thought he might have picked up from that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I don't see any reason why Wolves shouldn't think that they can overtake QPR and finish, not just outside the bottom three, but with one or two teams buffering.
Interesting time for Swansea as well.
They have overtaken QPR.
Yes, that's right. They're currently, fifth bottom? And but I think they should be looking at there or above.
Right. Well, the team just above them, sixth bottom,
is Aston Villa,
who are still 8 points off the drop. And yet, not sure how they manage it. Oh, because they got a point from the thing, because it was 7. And yet people still insist that they are the outside. They're the dark horses in the relegation race. Certainly their 0-0 at Wigan will have done little to improve morale, given that it was Robbie Keane's last game before going back to Los Angeles, and he's been really the brightest thing about them for this past month. Darren Bent getting injured as well, and we're not sure yet how long he's going to be out for. And the crowd having a go once again mercilessly at Alex McLeish.
I think that's the reason people are talking about Villa as possible relegation candidates, because it's the mood that surrounds the club and the fact that other clubs down there at the bottom, say your Wiggins, Bolton, those kind of clubs, probably can like foster a sense of embattlement and get the crowd on their side and get them behind them for a push to survive, whereas I don't think McLeish is going to be able to do that at Villa.
Still 8 points.
I know they've got it. They're quite a way above the relegation zone, but a few more defeats, and if they get pulled into it closer, then I mean, I just think that the fans will be barracking every week, and the players are not going to feel particularly good playing in that kind of atmosphere.
Well, Gabby Agbonlahor, who was captain, I think, on Saturday, came out after the game and said it's one of those seasons that you want to get out of the way, which is a straight, you know, with still a third of the season left to go, and you're drifting dangerously towards the bottom three. That's not a very driven sort of.
The project don't appear to have worked, and people are saying that Villa will keep clear of relegation because they've got strike force. Obviously, Bent is injured, but Gabby Agbonlahor's only got 5 goals. I think Emil Heskey has 1 league goal for the season, and Keane's gone back after his 3 goals, and then at the other end of the pitch, they've only kept 5 clean sheets. So, you know, for apparently defensive,
Dunn's out as well now, isn't he?
So it's not. Even if the fans were against him just because he used to be a blue nose, that he isn't actually delivering what he was hired to do, which was make them a bit more compact. And
all right, back-to-back relegations. Avram Grant managed it. Who knows?
It's not impossible.
Two clubs from the same city as well. Yeah. That'd be a feat.
Wouldn't it, though? Mm. Well, they've got Blackburn away next. Now, still to come on today's Top Football Weekly. All sorts of stuff. We've got posts. Look at this. Sid Lowe. Me talking about Italy, and lots on the Football League and Championship. Ay caramba. Better get cracking with that after this. Harry H13 posting on that extraordinary business of Porto reporting Man City to UEFA for their fans, saying, "You are not incredible," to Hulk. He says, "I think that 'You are not incredible' chant is the second most witty chant by fans this season, the first one being by Norwich fans at Old Trafford when they chanted, 'We have come for our scarves.' There should be some kind of award for these kind of chants." Now, in Italy, there is an award every year for the best banner or chant. Is there not something like that in the Premier League?
No. They should have best chant to the tune of Sloop John B, because that is what all chants are the tune of.
Lovely. I mean, some of the great banners that have won this award in Italy included, after the honour to the Tiger Arkan, you remember the Serbian war criminal thing, Lazio's next opponents held up a banner, I think it was Parma, saying "Honour to the cat Sylvester, wait, Sylvester in Italian, and the classic, which was when Napoli played Verona and they held up a banner saying "Juliet was a tart." I wasn't sure. Oh dear, the years haven't dulled its power, that one. Reading Rich, on an unconnected note, says, "I'm really appreciating what feels like extra coverage of the Championship this season, and what a great league it is too." Actually, some people are making the point, and indeed Philippe was making this a little bit the other day, that the level of the Championship does seem to have moved significantly closer to the Premier League. And Greg, you saw Cardiff, sixth place in the Championship, take Liverpool so very, very close this Sunday. With that in mind, let's now turn our thoughts to the Football League. Southampton top again after West Ham were held by Palace, and they had a big win against, who was it? It was Watford. Watford. Simon, yes. Were you there?
Or I wasn't there, no.
But you were following.
I was at my grandmother's birthday party.
Ooh, how did that go?
It was nice. Yeah, we had a lovely time.
Good.
Yeah, I baked a nice cake.
Did you? What kind of cake?
It was...
Were you happy with the water?
For the cake?
Yeah.
Yes, well, I got the best water I can, and there were no... horses?
In pinnies.
There were no horses anywhere near involved in the big competition.
This from the man who thought he'd killed Roy Hattersley with a mozzarella gun. It was Roy Hattersley, wasn't it?
It was. I didn't kill him.
Thought you did?
No. He chased me downstairs.
Oh, you missed
he
that
seemed
part.
To be... you can't... Well,
you
I'm
can't
assuming...
kill with mozzarella.
Well, can you kill somebody with mozzarella?
Yeah.
How did you kill somebody with mozzarella? Yeah, it was... Yeah.
Thank God.
It but was a dream. Ricky Lambert scored a hat-trick again, and I believe it was his third hat-trick of the season.
Wow.
Yeah, he is quite the sharpshooter.
Hmm.
So, Southampton are looking good once again, having had a slightly dodgy spell. West Ham disappointed draw.
Yeah, all right then.
And the bottom three clubs all won. Doncaster, Coventry, Bristol City all won.
Hmm.
I'm not sure that's happened before this season. And I think that everyone... above them in the league has just been thinking those three, they can't win, will be all right. But they all won on the same weekend, and I think the kind of five or so clubs above them are suddenly thinking,
which of course includes Portsmouth now after their...
Portsmouth are now in the bottom three.
But they didn't win, I thought they drew.
No, I'm talking about the three teams who have been in the bottom three.
At the start of the day, the teams in the bottom three.
Oh, right, so they dropped into the bottom three. All right.
That's right.
Mm.
And they're kind of... they've dropped into bottom three as a result of having 10 points taken away.
Yes.
They are not the three teams who have been there for a while now and have been looking in a glum old place.
All right.
The playoffs are still cracking. I mean, that you've got Reading are now third, who have been in great form of late. Blackpool keep on pulling out results. Kevin Phillips again. Birmingham, bad result. Then Cardiff, Brighton, Middlesbrough, they're all within 4 points of each other. And then you've got Hull as well, who've got a game in hand. I mean, it's really competitive.
What about down in League One, where those two Sheffield teams, John, are vying for an automatic promotion place, and they came face to face this very weekend, John? How was it?
It was, from my point of view, it was a bloody nightmare. The Blades lost. Second against third at Hillsborough. And Wednesday got the better of it, unfortunately, from my point of view.
Right.
Sounded like a typical scrappy derby game for the most part. United perhaps had the better of the first half and then stopped playing really in the second half as Wednesday got on top. And Chris O'Grady got a late goal, which United couldn't bounce back from. And it means that Wednesday have now closed to within 2 points of the Blades, who are second, although United still have two games in hand, one of which is this week against Scunthorpe.
Oh, excellent news.
The best story in League One, though, quickly moving on from that miserable event, came at Bournemouth.
Mm. What happened there, John?
Well, the co-owner's wife
was permitted into the Bournemouth changing room at half-time.
Just to put some perspective here, so Eddie Mitchell's been running that club for a while and brought them back from the brink of disaster. This Russian fellow, his name
Maxim
is...
Maxim something.
Maxim Demin, he bought 50% around Christmas time?
I think that's right, yeah.
And his wife got involved in the half-time team talk?
Well, his wife was there. I think, I'm not entirely sure if it was her first game, but it might well have been her first game. And she asked Eddie Mitchell if she could go and speak to the players in the tunnel as they came in from their first half against MK Dons. They were 1-0 down, and as Eddie Mitchell put it later, they were a bit pissed off. And so she didn't really get to wish them well in quite the style that she wanted to. So she then asked if she could go into the changing rooms to wish them all the best, which she did. Apparently, according to Mitchell, she doesn't speak particularly good English, and she's not very football intelligent, as she right. put it. But she, you know, wished the boys all the best for the second half, for which they then failed to improve on their 1-0 scoreline. Later on in the evening, the news of this team talk, well, the rumours that it had been a full-on team talk sort of started emanating out from the club. And so Radio 5 got hold of Eddie Mitchell, the Bournemouth chairman, to speak to him. And he did sound a little bit tired and emotional by this point. Swore at poor old Chappers, not once, not twice, but three times.
Imagine that.
Fulfilling. And yeah, so it was all a very unedifying spectacle.
Right. I thought, I heard about this story, I thought this is a rum old tale, I want to find out a bit more. So I googled Bournemouth dressing room. And the first story that came up was that opera singing pin-up Catherine Jenkins had been playing in Bournemouth last week. And a stranger stumbled into her dressing room as well.
Really?
It seems to be going on everywhere down there.
Amazing.
Well, did Catherine Jenkins then ring up 606 to say... Piss bollocks.
Oh, now you've done it here, yeah. John. Mitchell's got a bit of form, though, hasn't he, for unconventional club running. That business after the 3-0 defeat to Chesterfield.
He called out a fan in the...
He grabbed a microphone and appeared to beckon fans to come and challenge him, saying, "The lad in the leather jacket whose eyes seem to be popping out of his head, why don't you jump over the fence and come and have a chat with me? Come on, then, one-to-one," in best Delia Smith style.
It's a bit non-specific, that, though, isn't it? That leather is jacket, true. Bulging eyes, could be anybody.
Mm. He also, and this is far more sensible, told anyone who disagreed with his management style that they could go and support Southampton, which, you know, it's a local club
to do.
Doing well. Yeah, they have options. That's nice. Good. We are now going to dial up Sid Lowe in Spain. Sid Lowe in Spain. Sid, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, James. How are you?
Very, very well. You must be tired after what was an extremely busy day of Madrileño football for you yesterday.
Yeah, it was really exciting. It's rare that the league manages to program the timetables well enough that you can really take advantage of it. But yesterday afternoon, 4 o'clock in Vallecas, Rayo Vallecano against Real Madrid. Rayo Vallecano waited nearly a decade to host Real Madrid at home, and it was just a fantastic occasion. And then 9:30 last night, Barcelona in Madrid to face Atletico Madrid, and that was a pretty interesting game as well. They were both pretty great occasions, if not always brilliant games. But they had their moments, that's for sure.
All right, cool. The terrific back-heel goal from Ronaldo
goals as well. Yeah.
And the Messi goal.
The Messi goal was pretty special too, wasn't it? I must admit, I find it slightly tedious that every time you say, "Oh, great goal from," or "great goal from Ronaldo," people say, "Well, he's not as good as Ronaldo's or Messi's." Mm. But the trouble is that, of course, these two make it almost inevitable that happens every week because they keep on doing it. Ronaldo's was a really good back heel. I must admit, actually, I was a bit of a mix-up at Rio Stadium, so I didn't have accreditation, so I bought a seat in the stands. I was standing up all the way through because the fans were going crazy for it. So I was in the end where Ronaldo scored the goal. And actually, in terms of inspiration, I'm not convinced that it was that inspired because you could sort of see it coming. The way the ball came out of the area and the way the players were coming out, you could see that Ronaldo was going to back-heel it. You could see that was in his mind. You know, sometime before he actually did it, sometime we're talking, you know, half a second or something. And so in that sense, the idea, I think, was relatively clear. What was so impressive about it was the sheer amount of power and direction he got on the back heel. Really, really good finish and a really nice goal from a player who's having, you know, brilliant season.
So you were in among the Rayo fans because they're quite a bunch, aren't they? They're kind of the St. Pauli, they're Spanish equivalent of.
Exactly, and it was great fun, and this is one of the reasons why it's so good that Rayo are back in the first division, because they're different. They're a different kind of side. It's an old stadium that's kind of blocked in by the, I suppose you wouldn't really call it a town, it's a working class suburb of Madrid, Vallecas, which at one stage was a separate town. It's got a very distinct left-wing, working-class, high-immigration population now, which wasn't always the case. But that identity of being different to Real Madrid is still there. It makes an awful lot of noise. The fans carry Che Guevara banners, lots and lots of Republican flags, lots of songs, anti-fascist songs. They sing the Internationale, they sing the Marseillaise.
Did the Real fans join in with those, I imagine, did they?
Well, there's about 300 of them up in one course, but of course then shouted things back, to which Rayo fans started singing a song about how they wanted all out the stadium. And Mourinho afterwards complained that only around 300 Real Madrid fans went. He said, you know, I can understand that they don't go to Zaragoza or to Villarreal, but this is in Madrid and only 300 go. I'm not sure in truth there would have been tickets for more of them to go, because Rayo virtually packed the thing out. Cheapest seat, the one I was in was 60 euros. So even then it was full despite being in that barrio. They, as I say, they're also fans that carry things like Che Guevara banners, legalized cannabis banners, although frankly being in the stadium there's clearly no problem with smoking cannabis anyway. And it's just a great, great atmosphere.
Yeah, I love those little compact grounds where you're never far away from the grass, and that certainly sounds to be like it's the case at Vallecano. Now, in other news, Zaragoza lost 5-1 to Malaga, leading to an extraordinary press conference from the Zaragoza manager, it says here.
Yes, it does say that there. I'll explain why. The manager, Manolo Jimenez, who at Sevilla, I think we've talked about this before, had a fantastic chant that the Sevilla fans used to chant at him, which was Jimenez, Jimenez, que cojones tiene, which basically means Jimenez, Jimenez, what balls you have, because he was a dirty player and he was very aggressive and very tough and had a similar sort of attitude as a manager. But unfortunately, he's not being able to transmit that to the fan of the players, who basically couldn't care less. The club is in a terrible state, and so before we start blaming the players, absolutely you have to blame the owner, Agapito Iglesias, who's a disaster. They're on course for a third relegation, I think in 8 years, or might be nine now. And he, after the game, came into press conference. They'd lost 5-1 to Malaga. I can't remember the exact order, so forgive me if the details are not quite right, but he basically sat down and he said, OK, first goal was offside, the second goal came from a foul, and the third goal, some other reason why the third goal shouldn't have happened. And he said, but I'm going to stop putting excuses there. That's it. No more excuses. That's the end of that. No more excuses. And I'm very sorry for you lot who have a job to do, but let me do your job for you. I'm going to give you the headlines you want, because I'm not going to talk for very long. We can't play for only 20 minutes. It's an absolute disgrace. I feel ashamed of everything that's happened. I've had enough of this. And he basically said, so sorry about everyone. I'm disgusted by it all. Got up, walked out. To which, of course, the two press officers, one from each club, kind of looked at each other and went, meh, what do we do now then?
Go home early. Terrific.
Well, yes, exactly.
Fantastic. Sid, terrific stuff. Barcelona then keeping pace with Real Madrid, but looks all over for the title.
Yeah, James, it's worth pointing something out with Barcelona. Yeah. Apologies to, you know, for breaking your script and stopping you moving on to the next issue. Barcelona won 2-1, 1-0 up, 1-1, 2-1. Messi scored a really brilliant goal. Taking a free kick when Atletico weren't quite ready, but of course the referee hadn't told him that he couldn't take it. In fact, the referee to say, can I, to which the referee appears to say, yes, you can. He then did a really lovely shot into the top corner. After the game, Pep Guardiola said, I actually thought one of the interesting things was talking about yellow cards for handballs, but that's another long issue and we could be here forever. The key thing is that after the game, Guardiola said, I don't think we'll win the league.
Right. Well, I think that's a fairly rational response to their current situation.
But of course, in James, in Spain, nothing's a rational response.
Yeah.
So that's being treated as a kind of arrogant act by people in Madrid and as a masterstroke of games by people in Barcelona. Like you, I just think it's a bloke who says, well, let's face it, we're not going to win the league.
Big weekend in France, which we're not going to talk about, even though it had PSG fighting back to draw 4-4 with Lyon and Montpellier going top with a 1-0 win over Bordeaux. Paul Doyle's in on Thursday. He can take care of that business. What say we finish off what's been a bumper pod by answering all your questions, Simon Burton, on the weekend in Serie A?
Yeah, please.
All right, then. Questions like, wow, it was Milan against Juventus. Those two have been neck and neck for ever so long. Was there a decisive move by one or the other? Well, not really is the answer, Paul McInnes.
Oh, wasn't yeah.
there? No, it was 1-1, but there was so much controversy. The draw of poison, it was dubbed by the Gazzetta dello Sport. Basically, what happens is Nocerino scores first for Milan, puts them 1-0 up, and then, what's his name? Muntari scores, and Milan are 2-0 up. Only the linesman didn't see that the ball's gone about a metre over the line. And basically, it's gone about a metre over the line, and Buffon's grabbed it, and they've just thrown it out as fast as possible. Buffon then, who's the captain of Italy, and says afterwards, I didn't see that it had crossed the line. No, really, I didn't. But even if I had, I wouldn't have told the referee. And there's a bit of a kind of moral controversy going on about this, would you believe, in Italy. So there's a lot of bad feeling over that. Then you have a Juve goal, what would have been their equaliser, which is wrongly disallowed for offside. And then finally, they do score through Chiellini. So it finishes 1-1. But at the end, there's all sorts of bad feeling. Conte, the Juve manager, and Galliani, the vice president at Milan, have a real ding-dong slanging match at half-time, in which Galliani accuses Conte of being a crybaby, and Conte calls Galliani a mafioso. This is all top stuff. Then one of the commentators at the end, Carlo Pellegatti, at the end, basically, there's a bit of a rut between players and stuff, and particularly between Ambrosini and Chiellini. Ambrosini from Milan, Chiellini from Juve, because Juve fans, well, Juve's players feel that they've been hard done by one, two decisions, a red card for Arturo Vidal, and all the Milan fans at the Sincera, you had a completely valid goal against you disallowed, which would have put us 2-0 up. And even though, yeah, there was that offside call, 2-0 up, it would have gone a completely different way. So they're all outraged that Juve are having the temerity to complain. And the commentator starts going off on one. He starts shouting, "You're mentally ill," at Conte. He even calls him a dickhead. Extraordinary. Anyway, so there you go. So they remain with Milan just ahead of Juve, but Juve have a game in hand away to Bologna, which they're playing very soon, actually. Not the easiest games away to Bologna, so we'll have to see. In other Serie A news, Inter lost again. The whole month of February, they failed to score a single goal. They lost 1-0 this time away to Napoli. And they're not going to be in the Champions League next year. And it's going to be very interesting to see what that means for them. There is some talk that Claudio Ranieri may not be on the Inter bench come next Sunday, although we shall see.
Do they have a replacement lined
up? Not really, no. Mm. Doesn't seem like they do. I think they were thinking of people who might be otherwise employed at the moment and hoping.
Because there was an AVB rumour, wasn't there, last
week? Well, there was that, yeah. And there's also been a lot of JG, well, PG, if you like, Pep Guardiola. In other managerial round, I'm sorry.
I just had somebody tell me this morning through a friend of theirs who is a Spanish graphic designer it was nailed on that Pep is going to be the successor to Fergie. I hadn't heard this before. Is that common knowledge?
Very much so, Paul. Where were you?
I was obviously asleep on the job.
Now, in other managerial merry-go-round news, did we mention last week that Lazio's manager walked out just 40 minutes before they were getting on the plane?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so he walks out just before they're going to get the plane, and the kind of general manager says, you can't do this, you have to get on the plane because we don't have a manager, fly to Madrid, be in charge of the team just for this game, and then do what you want to do. So he does, and they lose against Atletico Madrid. And then the next day, Lazio, who've been in talks with Gianfranco Zola to be the replacement, announced a big press conference to meet the new manager. So all the press turn up, and the press conference keeps getting delayed and delayed, and the door opens, and in walks Eddie Reja, the same man from before, and he says, I am the manager. You're on candid camera. So all the press say, well, that's it. Well, didn't you just resign? He said, yeah, I did, but I've changed my mind. So he's still at Lazio. He said, you know, Zola deserves a big job like this, but he's not going to have this one for now. This is the second time he's done this of late. I think the second time this season, even. But he was rewarded with a 1-0 win on Sunday night at home to Fiorentina. And there you go. That's it for today's Football Weekly. Many thanks to you all for taking part. Simon Burton, Paul McInnes, Greg Ruffley, and John Ashton, and you, producer Ben, and you, listeners. We'll be back on Thursday. Enjoy the week, and, of course, those exciting, friendly internationals. More on all of those come Thursday. Bye for now.
For great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.